Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited. Subscribe to us through iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. Thank you for tuning in to Movie Geeks United, a great show for you tonight. A little bit later on the show, we'll be reviewing all the latest releases and talking about all the latest headlines and movie news, and we'll be discussing a new project titled Clan of the Vane with a trio of that project's producers. But first, I want to get to our headlining interview with legendary filmmaker Roger Corman. He just picked up an honorary Oscar a couple of years ago, and he's directed or produced over 400 films. He started the careers of talents like Jonathan Demme and Ron Howard and Jack Nicholson and Martin Scorsese. He's shaped the films that we love more than anyone in the culture. He has a brand new project. It's on YouTube. It's a subscription channel called Corman's Drive-In. For $3.99 a month, you get unlimited access to his ever-growing library of hundreds of films. We spoke with Mr. Corman earlier this week about that exciting project, and here's what he had to say. I'm so honored to have an opportunity to speak to you. This is a terrific thrill for me.
Well, very good. I'm familiar with Movie Geeks. I know you've had interviews with a number of people, including, I think, you have Jim Cameron, a couple of guys we worked with over the past.
Yes, sir. I mean, your contribution to film has meant so much to us on the show. It's done a large part in shaping our consciousness and our love of film, so we appreciate you very much. I know that you've experimented with various forms of distribution to get your films in front of audience eyes, but what made YouTube a good fit for you?
We were approached by representatives of Google, who, of course, own YouTube, and they have a new concept, which is they've offered individual channels to a number of independent production companies, and they chose us as one of them. They came up with the title Corman's Drive-In, which I think is a very good title. I'm not certain young people really know what a drive-in is. I had an interview at the Apple store in New York last week, and it was sent around, I don't know, everywhere more or less, and I said that I wasn't certain how many people knew what a drive-in was, but on the other hand, a number of people probably were conceived in drive-ins. So there's some connection there.
Yes. But how it's structured is you put out how many a month? How many films a month?
We have a library of a little over 400 pictures, and we put out 30 pictures each month. And for $3.99 a month, you subscribe, and you can look at all 30 or a few of them or none of them as you wish. And each month, we will replace those 30 with maybe 25 new ones, holding a couple from the previous 30. So this can go for a long time before we reach our 400 picture mark. And after that, After that, I don't know what we'll do, but I think we'll probably go back and intermix. And, of course, we're continuing to make new pictures, so it will grow.
Well, if you go on the website now at Corman's Drive-In on YouTube, some of your highest profile pictures are actually already posted and available for viewing on the website. Can you tell me a couple of those titles?
Yes. We have Eat My Dust, a car chase picture that Ron Howard starred in, which was a big success for us. We have Piranha, the first picture that Joe Dante directed, which again was a solid success for us. We have Stripped to Kill, which is an R-rated film that had a very unusual story. A police detective is called to go underground as a stripper to solve a murder in a strip club, and it was so successful that it led to, I don't know, we had murders in strip clubs, at least five different clubs. I think all you can say is it was dangerous to go to a strip club at that time. Mm. But then on the other hand, we had some very nice family films. We had Munchies, which was a big success for us, about some little creatures who, as a comedy, attacked a family, but it was really a comedy. We had The White Pony, a picture we shot in Ireland, which was, again, a family film about a little girl who has a white pony. Let me see. We had Dillinger and Capone, which is a very good story. It was very successful for us. Martin Sheen played Dillinger, and the man who got an Academy Award, I've forgotten his name for a moment, for the Mozart picture, Amadeus.
Murray Abraham, F. Murray Abraham.
Yes, Abraham plays Capone. We then had A Cry in the Wild, which won a number of awards. It was a very good film that my wife produced about a boy who is lost in the wilderness and has only a hatchet to survive. The original title of the novel was Hatchet, and it won a Newbery Award and has been sort of a consistent bestseller among young adults, adult books. And what happened, we were ready to release it, and we were going to put it in theaters, and the head of one of the theater chains was talking to me, and I talked about our children's picture, Hatchet. And he said, "Well, Roger, everybody knows you make horror films. You can't go out with a children's picture called Hatchet." So I realized the misunderstanding, and it became A Cry in the Wild.
Mm. You know,
Jack Nicholson's first film, Crybaby Killer, when he was, I think, 19 years old, he played a teenager who takes a drive-in restaurant hostage under some very strange circumstances.
I'm definitely going to ask you about your work with Mr. Nicholson. But first of all, when I first read the press release announcing the channel, the first thought that came to my mind is, this is terrific. It would be made even more terrific if Mr. Corman did kind of an introduction to the films and you got a behind-the-scenes kind of look at some of these. And I went to the channel, and lo and behold, that is actually part of the content.
Yes, we're fairly busy. I have two pictures that I'm editing, one picture that starts next Monday, another picture that starts in 4 weeks, another picture starting in September. So my time is fairly limited, but what I'm doing, I'm recording three introductions to different pictures every day. So eventually I'll catch up with the whole 30.
Mm. Yeah, that's terrific, because so many people, for movie geeks like myself and our audience in particular, you are such a source of inspiration and also education for us. And a big part of your legacy has been shaped by the many people that started out with you, that you kind of acted as a mentor towards. And I was always curious about you in your own life and career. Who was your mentor?
I don't think I really had a mentor. I graduated from Stanford with a degree in engineering, And I became the movie critic of the Stanford Daily, primarily because I found out that they had two critics. The critics got free passes to all the theaters in Palo Alto. So I started off just to get three free passes to the theaters, then became swept up in films. But I grew up in Southern California, so I already knew some kids whose parents were in the film industry. And I just decided engineering was not for me, but it was easier to get the degree and graduate and get out. And then went into films. So I had no real mentors. Maybe I watched certain directors' films, Hitchcock particularly, John Ford, Howard Hawks, Fritz Lang's films. Oh, and I was always struck by the great Russian director, Eisenstein. I remember particularly Battleship Potemkin, which I thought was very early brilliant editing.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned some of the foreign filmmakers that influenced you. And you, what I was surprised to learn when I watched the documentary the other year, Corman's World, was the fact that you supported and distributed quite a few foreign films. And I was curious about the approach you took, because you would program films from Bergman, I believe, and Fellini, but at the drive-in. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, that happened one time. We distributed, let me see, Bergman, Fellini, Truffaut, Kurosawa, Volker Schlondorf, the German director, Alain René, a number of them. And we distributed them in the normal, what were called art house theaters in the major cities, and particularly in college towns. And with the first film we distributed from Bergman, Cries and Whispers, was very successful for us. And in the fall, it had just about finished its run in art houses. And I was aware we put a lot of our pictures in drive-ins, which was a big part of the way we distributed. And I knew that in the fall, the major studios didn't want to put their pictures in drive-ins because the business was fading, cold weather was coming in, and so forth. But the drive-ins were looking almost desperately for films to keep going until finally snow or something closed them down for the winter. So I just got the idea of, why not put Cries and Whispers in a drive-in? And I did, almost as an experiment, as sort of a funny experiment, to see if it would work. And I remember it was a drive-in owner, actually in the South, in New Orleans, and he was a little surprised that through my sales manager we called, and he said, why not? We're not doing much business in the fall anyway. And we did average business. Nobody was happier than we were to do average business. And I got a letter from Ingmar, I knew him slightly, thanking me for people said, you know, Bergman's going to be really upset. You're putting his picture in a drive-in and then in other drive-ins. I got a letter from him thanking me for bringing his pictures to a whole new audience that he had never anticipated.
Absolutely. That is actually my favorite Bergman film, and I can't imagine how wonderful it must be to watch that at a drive-in. That would be such a unique environment for that film. That's wonderful. But, you know, you're going back to the documentary that was made about you, Corman's World, and speaking of your beginnings with Jack Nicholson, I think one of the most touching, revealing moments of Nicholson on film is from that documentary when he speaks of his reverence for you. And I was curious, when you saw that moment with Jack, what went through your mind?
I was a little bit surprised that he somewhat choked up with emotion. We've been friends for a long time. Of course, his career has gone in different directions from mine. But he did his first number of films for me, and he actually wrote several pictures for me. He was a very good writer. People were people were are not aware of the fact that he's a good writer. If he had succeeded as an actor, he would have had a major career as a writer. So we've sort of been through the wars for many years together, and I was very touched by the things he said.
There's nobody in there that he didn't, in the most important way, support. He was, you know, my main connect, my lifeblood to whatever I thought I was going to be as a person. And, you know, I hope he knows that this is not all hot air. I'm going to cry now. Not just me, who's very sentimental, but these other people also love him. Sorry.
You know, I want to talk to you a little bit about the state of motion picture producing and the industry as a whole. There was a high-profile conversation, I think, that Spielberg and Lucas gave a week or two ago, where Spielberg basically predicted that in the near future, probably the big studios will suffer some major disasters. Maybe four or five or half a dozen big blockbusters will flop, and they'll have to rethink their approach, and it will result in something that we saw in the late 60s, early 70s, where they'll have to kind of redefine the business. Do you see that on the horizon, or do you think that's very much a lost kind of place in the past that we'll never get back?
I think there's a vague truth to it. As a matter of fact, I've been quoted over the last couple of years as saying somewhat a similar statement. They're making these $1 and $200 million pictures and more, and I've said a couple of times that one or two of these films are going to fail, and they already have, and the day will come when more than one or two, maybe three or four will fail, and they will start to rethink what they're doing. And I think, and I agree with Steve, but I think it will not go as far as he says. I think they will simply broaden their production base. They will continue making these big blockbusters, but they'll be somewhat more careful. Now they're just sort of saying, okay, Batman has been successful, let's make Batman 72. Superman is successful at the moment, let's make five more Supermans or ten more or whatever. But enough of them, I think, are going to fail that they will say, all right, we will continue making these films, but we'll be a little more choosy as to what we will make. And the questionable ones, we're not going to go with. Of course, what was it? William Goldman, Academy Award-winning screenwriter, made that great statement, nobody knows anything. And it's almost correct. But I think most people know something, but we don't know it all. So I think they'll try to predict a little more carefully, and they will go, I think, to a broader base. Right now, some of the most interesting films are being made by independent producers on lower budgets, and a number of those are quite successful, and they've been also dominating Academy Awards and other award ceremonies that increases their visibility. So I think the studios will start to go a little bit in that direction, but they will not give up totally on the blockbusters.
Right, right. It's really film. The film theatrical experience has really become akin to a theme park ride, I think. But the positive note here is that there are many other avenues for the independents to break through, whether it's on demand or online, and the process has become a lot more democratic. That has to make you happy.
Yes, that's one of the reasons for Corman's Drive-In. We see that the amount of playing time in theaters for independents is shrinking. I wouldn't say it's zero, but it's not too much above zero. And as a result, we have to look for other means of distribution. The independents do play theaters to a certain extent, and they will undoubtedly, as a matter of fact, they might even increase their share a little bit because a number of the big films are failing, and there's enough of an audience that wants to see a different type of film. But also, DVDs have been very important to us. However, DVDs are slowing a little bit in their sales. They're not slowing as much as some people think they are, but it's definitely a downward curve. And Corman's Drive-In is a way to make it, as you say, more democratic. We can go straight to our audience. We can eliminate the middleman. I have nothing against theater owners and distributors, but we can go straight from our own production facility to the audience. We can deliver the films for a fraction. I mean, 30 pictures a month for $3.99, it's pretty tough to beat that price. So I think this is one of the ways that films are going to be distributed in the future.
I think so, too, and it's incredibly exciting to me. I want to ask you about something, about your honorary Oscar, because every year on the show we do a series where our kind of memo to the Academy and before they announce their honorary Oscar winners. And for years we kept pushing for Roger Corman. Roger Corbett, he deserves one. This is our plea. And so we were so pleased to see that you got one. And what was that evening like being up there and actually holding an Oscar?
Well, it was a double evening because the honorary lifetime Oscars are given at the Governor's Ball, which is a big party for the members of the Academy. So they actually present you with the Oscar at the Governor's Ball, and each person gives a little short speech, and I talked about the importance of the independents and of the fact that independents at the moment are more innovative and are more experimental and creative than many of the majors, and it was important to nurture that creativity. Then we got a second time around at the actual Oscar broadcast, where Lauren Bacall and I both got them that year, and they announced us, and we stood up, which we were told to do, and the audience stood up and started applauding, and it was going on and on. I thought, well, this is enough, and I started to sit down, and they kept applauding, so I stood up again. Then a little while later, Lauren started to sit down. They kept applauding, so she stood up, and finally it came to an end, and when we sat down, she said, well, we really screwed that one up. I said, no, Lauren, they like us.
They love you, absolutely. When I announced that you're going to be on the show, we had so much enthusiasm from many of our listeners, and I invited them to submit a question for you. I picked a couple, if you'll indulge me just for a few moments. One of our listeners, Nilosri, I believe is the name, the way you pronounce it, she has a question. Is it a big challenge when you're working with a low budget to make those kind of budgetary restrictions not affect the storytelling?
It is a challenge. And sometimes you can find a way to do an effect inexpensively that's better than doing it conventional way. I remember when I shot Machine Gun Kelly, we had a limited number of sets, and he was supposed to rob a bank. This was a small robbery, and it was a minor sequence, and there was no way we could build a bank set for just a short sequence. So I thought about it, and what I did, we built a door and a little bit of a wall, and I had Charlie Bronson, it was his first starring role, playing Kelly, go into the bank with a submachine gun, and then we see the shadow on the wall of the quick robbery he pulls. And the critics, particularly the French critics, praised my thinking in showing the robbery through a shadow. They weren't aware that I'd done it only because I didn't have enough money to build a set.
Well, it really does force you to make more creative decisions, because it's not something you can throw money at, as so many films and studios do. And I think that's exceptional. I think that's a major part of what makes your film special, and the independent films in general. Christopher wants to know what it was like to work with Vincent Price.
It was really a great pleasure to work with Vincent. He was my first choice for the first of my Edgar Allan Poe pictures, Roderick Usher, in The Fall of the House of Usher, because he almost was Usher. He was a cultivated, intelligent, sensitive man and actor. He fit the role perfectly. And as we made more pictures together, we became friends, and I began to appreciate how intelligent he was. His comments on the scripts we would make, I pretty much shoot a script 80% the way it's written, but I modify a little bit with the actors as we're shooting, as almost every director does. And Vincent's comments and insights were very, very good. Plus, he was just a good guy.
And finally, last question. This comes from Matthew. This is a good one. Having included lots of subversive social commentary in a lot of your movies, what is the one socio-political topic you have yet to explore but like to?
All right. It takes me a moment to think about that. In The Intruder, I dealt with racial prejudice. And it was Bill Shatner's first picture, as a matter of fact. He had just come out from New York. He was a Broadway actor. And that film got great critical reviews. It won a couple of minor film festivals, but was not so successful commercially. After that, I tried to deal with these patterns on sort of a subtextual level. If it was a gangster picture, it would be a gangster picture, but underneath there would be, as we say in method acting, a subtext, as in Bloody Mama, the Ma Barker gang story. Underneath, there was a concept of the dispossessed farmers and poor people. In this case, it turned to crime during the Depression. If there were any social situation today, take me a moment to think of something. One of the first I would do, and I don't know exactly how it can be done, but it can be done, and that is the growing disparity between the inequality between the rich and the poor. I read some statistics recently that we have the greatest differential, as it were, in wealth since before the Depression and the stock market crash of 1929. And statistically, when there's been this great a disparity in income, there has been some sort of social upheaval, which took place in 1929 and in the 30s and led to all of the reforms of Roosevelt and the New Deal. I'm not certain there's going to be any great social upheaval, but it is a situation that worries me and concerns me.
Okay, that was Roger Corman. Subscribe to his YouTube channel right now at youtube.com/Corman's Drive-In, and we thank Mr. Corman for his time. Let me bring up my co-host. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, what's up?
How are you guys?
We're good. How are you?
How are you guys? Hey!
Hey!
All right, let's talk about World War Z. How did it do this weekend? I haven't checked the grosses. It came in second.
I think it's number two. It's done much. It's like supposedly like the best opening for a non-franchise movie. Like not, you know, it's like, so it's done very well.
And the best opening for Brad Pitt, personally.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that interesting, though? He's been in so many good movies, but none of them are like, you know, he has the George Clooney disease. He's a movie star, but he's not a blockbuster star.
Is it his last big hit, Mr. and Mrs. Smith? Maybe that was the last really big...
Yeah, yeah, that's the same.
Oh, the Jennifer Aniston Dear John letter. Yeah, okay. I love that movie. It's a cinematic Dear John letter.
Well, World War Z really actually exceeded expectations because they're expecting it to open at $50 million. It opened at $66 million. And so, bless him. I mean, he needed it because a lot was riding on this, and I'm sure it's doing well internationally. So.
No, it is doing well internationally. It's a really good movie, and I don't, you know, I read the book. I was thinking about this like 7 years ago, but I don't care. It's not faithful to the book. I mean, there's no way it could be.
Yeah, the book. that's what you, just made it clear. Yeah. I mean, I learned about the book that not having any real main characters. So,
yeah, it's like an oral history of this, like, zombie thing, you know, zombie plague or whatever. And, you know, there's no way you could do that. You can maybe, if you want to do the book, then the best way to do that was in, like, an HBO series or, you know, or in television format.
It sounds like if it's been done, like, as a faux documentary or something like that, it might have.
Yeah, I mean, so I thought it was, well, I thought it was incredibly well done. I think the idea is terrifying enough. I want to see, though, the stuff that cut, though. I hope we'll be able to see that one day.
Man, I mean, it's too grandiose not to include it in the Blu-ray release, because when we're talking about at least a half hour of reshot footage, and that represents tens of millions of dollars, it needs to be seen. I mean, get it out there. What's the harm?
I know, yeah. No, I would love to see that.
I mean, why was it originally reshot anyway? I mean, what was the problem?
It didn't work. They said it didn't work, and they showed it. I was reading about this earlier. It supposedly did not work. When you sit down and watch it, it doesn't work.
Okay. What did they?
But I don't know. I could be wrong about that.
Or whatever.
No.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why it didn't work. Because in the midsection of the film, before you get to the last third, the conclusion of the movie that they reshot, you have two back-to-back action sequences that are as tense and exciting as any you're likely to see this year. So then their original ending was this big, epic, another battle in Russia, I believe. And it was just, I think it was just too much. And you could tell with how they reshot the ending that they really pared it down. The ending action sequence is kind of its most intimate. And what it reminded me of was the ending of Jurassic Park. You know, when
that's a good point. That's a great
going around and trying not to disturb the dinosaurs and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it works.
Good point.
And it does, you know, it does give you kind of a chance to catch your breath, and it builds this momentum, that conclusion. You know, the movie itself, for me, I think there are some genuine faults of the movie, and then there are some faults that people are going to lay on it that aren't quite fair. Like, it's not like the book, or it's not bloody enough, or blah, blah, blah. But
I could throw out the window. I could throw all those complaints out the window.
Yeah, but the movie as a movie, you got to ask, does it work? And for me, the movie is an exercise in propulsive filmmaking. I mean, you have 5 minutes of setup before this movie starts taking off. This is pretty much the most breathlessly paced action movie I've seen in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Jamie. I couldn't agree more with you. You thought it was at least 5 minutes? I thought maybe 3 minutes. 3 minutes,
yeah,
right there.
Just about.
But I like the opening credits. I thought were a great way to, you know, like Zack Snyder's remake of Dawn of the Dead did, was a great way of setting up the whole movie. I really thought if you had to pay attention to the opening credits, because I thought that was a very smart credit sequence.
Yeah, I do too. But then again, it didn't necessarily labor on how did we get here. It wasn't necessarily a process movie like a Contagion is or something like that. It's more like we got to find a solution, and we're not going to, it's not overly political.
One wants a zombie, a political zombie movie.
Somebody should work on that. That would be interesting.
Well, Romero made
Contagion,
clear.
Contagion, though, it's good, interesting, because someone said it was like Contagion with zombies. I don't feel that way. What I like about Contagion is I can go back and find something new in it every time. I love Contagion.
I love Contagion, too. But I made that comment that it's like Contagion with zombies, just based on a superficial comparison. It's a globe-spanning movie about an epidemic that they're trying to solve. Superficially, it is structured like a Contagion.
Yeah, okay, I could see that. But I think you...
Yeah, it gives you pause. You think, though, I mean, how, and The Mist does this to a lesser extent, too, just how we devolve so quickly, Law and Order and everything. I think that scene in the supermarket, and then the cop, the scene with the cop.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just wants to get stuff, too. I mean, he, you know, I thought that it's those kind of scenes, though, in World War Z that really, I thought, like, struck a chord, though.
But here are the complaints about, one of the major complaints about the movie. That possibly can open it up to a different kind of conversation. When you're spending $225 million or however much they spend on it, you have to make compromises. You would think the more money you spend, the more freedom it will give you, but that's not necessarily the case because the studio has such an incredible investment in this film. They cannot afford to exclude any possible audiences from this movie. So it's not going to be bloody. It's not going to be political. For me, I looked at it as a positive and as an example of what Hollywood does best with a big summer genre film. And that this is a prime example of it. I mean, we make these movies better than anybody. And there's something to be said for just the sheer awe-inspiring enjoyment of a good action movie, and that's what
right.
this is.
I agree with you there. I like even within those first 20-25 minutes, I like the when they find refuge with the family in the apartments in Newark. I thought that was a good sequence, and I like the outcome of that. I thought it was great. I thought that was very touching. It's just a lot of, I mean, there are overall a lot of good choices that Mark Forster and everyone made in the movie.
I think so, too. And it's directed in a way that you can tell everything that's going on. Because I watched it again in 2D yesterday. I watched it in 3D the first time around. And unlike Man of Steel, I could tell what was going on in the action sequences. And honestly, I equate that to Robert Richardson's work because I could watch that movie and I could tell what Richardson shot. I mean, some of it was a dead giveaway. The harsh overhead lighting, you know, and a lot of those scenes. The stuff in the hallway with the red lights and everything when they're trying to get out of that building.
Right.
A lot of it's obvious, and he shot the majority of the film, I believe. So, and then it went to Michael Bay's cinematographer, I think.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I liked it a lot, and it needs a star to anchor it. I mean, it's not a great performance by Brad Pitt. It's an appropriate one. A big epic studio movie like that, you need that presence in the center of it.
You need the Brad Pitt from Troy. You need that. I think that's what you need. You need that Brad Pitt. You need, and I think we get that and more better than Troy, actually. I'll say that. But you do. That's the funny thing. Brad Pitt can do these things where he'll go from the big blockbuster to the supposedly smaller film. But he does deliver. He doesn't get the credit he deserves, but he really does deliver.
Yeah.
I think
the female
the
role
part.
Is completely underwritten. I would have liked it to have included more moments of, like, horrific intimacy in it. Of what exactly – because the movie is – told on an epic scale, so when you get the zombies, you get them in swarms of thousands. You know, I missed the what is spoken of late in the film when the wife turned and killed her son. That's spoken of late in the film. The best zombie horror, and even something like The Walking Dead, they portray moments like that, and that really brings home what makes zombieism such a frightening theme:
right.
the intimacy of it.
Yeah, like
that's not what you get here.
You know, you don't get that. Like in the second one, the 28 Weeks Later, where Robert Carlyle, I think, is watching his wife or whatever become a zombie. I always found that to be just such an intensely disturbing scene in the beginning of that.
All right. So good. I'm glad it's doing well. Let's see how it drops off. How much does Superman drop off? I'm looking at it now. It dropped off 65%. For a third place
that's
finish.
More than usual, isn't it? I'm not sure it's more. It's doing well, though, overseas, though, I think. So, I mean, that's where it's really doing well is overseas. Okay.
Yeah. Well, when you start off so large, you know, you're going to get a steep drop-off. But
you are.
I guess people generally like Man of Steel among the audiences. They like
it? I think people like it. I mean, I like it more than I hate it, but I still think it has problems. I think the first half of the movie's perfect. I think the movie's awesome until he decides to become Superman, if that makes sense. I think the movie is really top-notch, top-shelf. And then when he decides to give himself to humanity, then I think the film becomes, becomes boring, actually, if that's possible.
Well, the action does become monotonous. And
that's
numbing.
The problem, the action. The action is monotonous. That's the problem. You have two super beings going at it, and, you know, after a while, you're just like, enough, fellas.
Yeah. And do you concur with the idea that Superman should kill? Are you okay with that?
Am I okay with that?
Honestly, I'm not. I don't think.
I didn't realize this was such a big. This is you. How out of touch I am. I didn't realize this was a big thing. I thought that was with Batman. He doesn't kill. I am. I do have a trouble. I mean, you mean all this. All this you guys are going through, and this one simple action, and oh, that's all I had to do? I mean, really?
All you got to do is break his neck? Oh, geez.
Yeah, I mean, really? I don't think Terrence Stamp wouldn't have stood for that.
I liked how they played with the story, but oddly enough, the elements that they chose to make it more modern here and there, I did kind of roll my eyes out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I did kind of have a problem with him breaking his neck. I thought that was a cop out, and I did kind of roll my eyes at the conclusion with the drone.
I didn't like that just because I didn't like the way that ended. Now I like the actual ending of the movie where he at the Daily Planet. I like, but
yeah,
I thought that part with the drone and with the military and everything, I was just really this. That was fine for a TV series, and from what I heard, people prefer Smallville to this. From like diehard Superman fans actually do prefer the TV series. I've heard a lot of grumblings in that regard, but it just reminded me of something like bad 80s TV series like Pilot Conclusion. That's what the ending that here reminded me of with the drone. I just thought it was unnecessary. It was stupid.
Well, and Zack Snyder's coming back to do the next one, and I just... clean up the way you direct action. It honestly gave me a headache trying to watch the conclusion of this movie. You know, I was trying to tell what the frick was going on.
right.
And, you know, I've seen Watchmen in 300. I never saw that Sucker Punch. I saw bits and pieces, but...
Well, Sucker Punch is the...
Undoubtedly.
Here's the thing with Sucker Punch. The action is the worst part of the movie. The action sequences go on way too long. They're like sort of a foreshadowing of what's wrong here. Is the action sequences are the least interesting part of the film?
Did you guys read that article in the Independent? I guess it's a British magazine today.
The British newspaper, the Independent. What was the article? What was the?
It's covering David Lynch and talking to him mostly about his new album, but he had something pretty disturbing to say about his...
he'll never make another movie. I saw that. Sacha Stone reposted that.
His quote is, it's a very depressing picture. He says, I don't know what's happening in cinema. It hasn't settled into what it's going to be next. And he says, now it's settling... He says it's a very depressing picture with alternative cinema, any sort of cinema that isn't mainstream. You're fresh out of luck in terms of getting theater space and having people come and see it. Even if I had a big idea, the world is different now. And unfortunately, my ideas are not what you'd call commercial, and money really drives the boat these days. So I don't know what my future in cinema is, but I don't have a clue what I'm going to be able to do in that world.
If it were any other director that hadn't directed for a while that said that, I might agree. But since when were Lynch's ideas commercial? Since he's been making movies, since when has the business not been about making money? So he's David Lynch. He will get his film out there if he makes one. I just don't, because he's such an anomaly. I mean, there's no one that makes films like him anyway, so the rules don't generally apply to him. Nobody compares him to a Man of Steel. You know, his
right.
movies are different.
Well, maybe it's almost
had
like
some
a pop-out.
Maybe he had some kind of trouble to get his movies made. It's possible. It sounds like it.
Well, I think he made the last one. He wasn't... You know, and plus we have On Demand and all these different choices for him now, and he might think that's too small for film, but he's the one that swore by digital. He's the one that made his last movie with a $500 digital camera.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's true.
He could make something. I mean, I think...
Maybe he's just fallen out of love with movies.
I think
maybe
that could
just,
be.
Maybe that's it.
But on our Facebook page lately, I've been posting, like, on this day, however many years ago, this movie
I
came
love
out.
Those!
Yeah, and it really gives you an opportunity to, like, go back through memory lane with some of these.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, today, the day we're taping this, June 23rd is when we're taping this, was the day that Batman came out.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
In 89?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How much did the original Batman change things?
Big time.
It did.
I mean,
it made
the marketing of Batman changed everything, I think. You know, I mean, I couldn't go anywhere in New York City that year without seeing that logo, that gold and black logo.
You want to hear something even funnier? I was disappointed. We were initially disappointed with the movie. It was only through repeated viewings that I actually grew to like it. I just thought it was so overhyped and overrated.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I was actually taken in by the hype and actually loved the movie when I first saw it. And then I went to go see it about a week later, and I was like, oh, my God, what was I thinking? This is embarrassing. you know. I even bought the soundtrack, the Prince soundtrack and everything, because back then
mm-hmm.
I was on the end run of my being a Prince fan, you know. I think that kind of killed my Prince fandom, actually, with that soundtrack album.
I mean,
you know, I like it too, but, you know, I stopped buying his records after that.
Prince is the biggest musical genius alive right now. I still believe that.
He's great and, you know, and everything.
And
I
actually listened to his Batman soundtrack again last week.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bat Dance is laughable. But there's a couple of songs in there, like Lemon Crush and Vicky Waiting and Electric Chair, that I really, really dig. The problem is that his music had no business being in that movie.
I agree with that.
He was in the editing studio, and he said, I have no idea how to use the music for this movie. They just wanted a soundtrack to accompany the film. And I think it was Nicholson's suggestion that they use Prince, because Nicholson was a huge Prince fan.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah.
No, but it's a good... I mean, I do like that one. I like the second one. But I got to be honest, the first time I watched this one, I was underwhelmed.
I remember talking about it to other kids in high school. I mean, we were so excited about it. I think it was my senior. It wasn't my senior year yet. But we were talking about the movie amongst my friends, and we were just so hyped for it. And I bought my ticket on Ticketmaster and waited in line all night, like around the shopping plaza. The line curled up to the theater, and it was a big deal. It was, you know,
it was an enormous deal.
Somebody that wasn't of age to see Star Wars at the theater at that time, because I was like barely
mm-hmm.
four when Star Wars came out. This was my first like mega movie that had that kind of mania around it.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Well, no, that's not true. Because I just didn't feel it with the Star Wars movies. Because
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I was too young to kind of feel it. But Batman, it really came alive for me. The event film.
Right. Well, it was the first event film. I mean, you had that summer. Remember, you had that, and then a couple of weeks before, you had Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which was the first
right.
big movie for me in years. And then you had Star Trek V, which is the less said the better. But then after that, you had Lethal Weapon 2. I mean, it was a big summer, that summer movie.
Anniversaries. Oh, What do you guys think of the Wolf of Wall Street trailer?
Oh, my God. When can I watch? Can I watch it right now? I love that trailer. That trailer is so awesome. It's kind of bizarre, though, don't you think? I mean, I wasn't really – it's definitely colored and kind of shaped, at least in this trailer, as a comedy more than anything else.
Oh, yeah, but I mean – is this based on?
And no, I'm telling you, it's written by the guy that wrote the book, and it's about his life.
Oh my God, life.
He does lectures and stuff right now because he spent some time in prison. Let me find his name.
Okay, I don't want his life. I take that back. Okay, I don't want this.
Jordan Belfort.
Okay. Dude, this movie looks awesome. Can't we go see it right now? I want to watch it right now. Dude, the trailer is incredible. I mean, it's just an incredible
trailer. It's a great trailer. What it sells is the adrenaline and the carefree and the wasteful attitude. And then there are seconds in the trailer where you get a glimpse of the downfall that's going to occur.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be brutal, man. It's going to be brutal.
It's probably the first in a series of trailers, you know, and we'll get another trailer that is darker in tone, I suspect. This might be like sort of their summer movie trailer, you know what I'm saying?
That's a good point.
And then, you know, as we get closer to fall, we'll get the fall movie trailer. you got to see it.
I'll tell you what I did see. I saw the first episode of Ray Donovan, which is the Showtime series that premieres June 30th. It's Liev Schreiber and John Voight in it. Because I read the review of the first three or four episodes on Hollywood Reporter, and they could not have been more glowing about it. They're like, Showtime has a major gem on its hands and all this kind of stuff. And it's intriguing from the first episode. I wouldn't say that you get a sense that it's a surefire hit, but it's got enough interesting elements at play that it'll be of interest to see how it plays out. But, and John Voight, I mean, they talked about how great John Voight is in this review. He really seemed over the top to me in this one episode, and I swear to God, he was making Paul Cerrone faces all the way through from Anaconda.
Oh my God, really?
It looked like he was playing
God.
Paul Cerrone.
But it looks fascinating. It looks like a fascinating series. I mean,
by the way,
at least from
crazy,
the trailer.
It's crazy to me that you know that character's name from Anaconda. I just have to say that. But
no, it's one of his favorite movies. Come on.
It's one of my favorites. Absolutely. And
yeah, it's one of his favorites.
My
Come
favorite
on.
Boyd performance. Paul Cerrone is an unforgettable character. I did like a skit where I played Paul Cerrone. And I did, like, the opening monologue from Patton. Like, we green-screened an American flag behind me, and I did it as Paul Cerrone.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm crazy about Anaconda, man.
Well, it's interesting. You know, last night, you mentioned John Voight. Last night, I finally took a look at Looking to Get Out, the Hal Ashby movie from 1982. Have you guys seen that movie? Yeah.
I haven't seen the director's cut, but yeah.
Have you seen it? That movie was great.
We did a whole Hal Ashby retrospective. I mean, it was all
surrounding that movie. I went to the premiere with Voight and Burt Young when the director's cut premiered.
God, I love that Burt Young interview, man. That Burt Young interview is awesome.
Yeah.
I tell you, I really love that movie. I thought that movie was a lot of fun.
And you know what makes it work mostly? What makes it work mostly is the unbelievable chemistry between John Voight and Burt Young. They are great together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're really funny together. They looked like they were doing major improv, but it's cut together so well that. It really gives you the sense of these two characters that can find the humor in just about anything. Like, I love that there's that sort of little chase scene that's happening towards the end of the movie, you know, where they're being chased by these two guys that are trying to get money out of them. because they're both inveterate gamblers, and they've got well, John Boyd especially has terrible impulse control, but they're being chased by these two hoods and all through the back lot of the back rooms of this casino, and Voight and Young are actually sort of like laughing at the predicament that they're in, and actually making jokes and making each other laugh like they're two big kids, you know, that are just trying to have some fun, and that really came across. I don't understand why that movie didn't get the release that it deserved. I mean, what was the problem with that film? Did the studio just sort of take it away from Ashby?
Yeah.
The
film that you saw is much different from the original release. Apparently, the original release, it wasn't good at all. Like, nobody liked it. It wasn't good, and Al Ashby hated it, and John Voight knew that it was all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So, but Ashby had re-edited it without telling anyone and gave it to UCLA or something, and it was uncovered as this guy was writing his biography on Hal Ashby.
Mm-hmm.
John Voight didn't even know it existed.
Hmm. Well, I do think that it needed to be cut down still a little bit by like maybe about 5 minutes, because there's certain scenes in it that go on a little too long, but I thought it hung together pretty well. It's good that it's out there. You know, it was very interesting seeing the young Angelina Jolie at the very end of it.
Yeah, yeah.
That was before
she hated her father. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
I remember that. I remember doing putting together that show.
That was a great piece. The whole thing is awesome. That whole period we did before that was just incredible.
Because that was only one of two times that these guests have actually called my cell phone. And when somebody calls...
Tom Boyd has your number.
Yeah. So when somebody calls me on my cell phone and not in the comfort of being on my switchboard on the show here, I get really nervous. Like, I don't know how to talk. So when because I sent my interview request to him for the movie, and he called like 10 minutes later, and I was like a stammering idiot. I was like, oh, Jesus, John Voight just called my cell phone, and I didn't know how to react. And he said, all right, let's do this interview thing. I said, all right, can we do it in 10 minutes so I can program the show? And he said, sure. And then I was very comfortable talking to him once I got in my element. But
right.
So we had that interview, and then we had the interview with Ashby's biographer, and then I was trying to get Burt Young. And we weren't able to get him until a couple hours before the show. His publicist called me, or whoever it was, publicist or manager, and said, okay, he wants to do the show. What time does he need to call in? And I said, 11 o'clock. Is that too late? And he started laughing. He said, no, Bert doesn't go to sleep, so that's fine. Like Bert doesn't go to bed by 11. Yeah, you don't have to worry about that. So
you don't have to worry about that. Now, that was great. That interview was so much
was
fun, too.
He started crying during the interview, talking about
Ashby.
Good one.
I remember you mentioning that now in a past episode. But, well, anyway, I was really thrilled by it. And what great-looking movie, too. Half the way for photography and so forth. I mean, Robert Boyle, art direction is really, you know, it's just nothing. I really didn't have too many bad things to say about it when it was all over. It was like, wow, that's the first really, really fun movie I've seen in a little while.
Hold that thought, because bad things to say about the movie. There was this article of directors dissing other directors. Dean, you posted it, right?
That's right,
Let me try to find it, because it was really...
Isn't this an article that was posted a couple months ago, though? I remember reading some of these. I mean,
it might be, but it was new to me, so...
Okay, all right. Oh, wow, okay.
This 30 Harshest Filmmaker on Filmmaker Insults in History is on Flavor Wire.
I want to hear all these.
Well, some of them are done by, you know, they've got numerous ones from certain directors. So obviously these are some of the more cantankerous ones. I love it. Let's do it.
Okay, Ingmar Bergman on Michelangelo Antonioni. He said,
they both died the same day.
Yeah, they did, as a matter of fact. Fellini, Kurosawa, and Buñuel moved in the same field as Tarkovsky. Antonioni was on his way but expired, suffocated by his own tediousness. Wow. Ingmar Bergman on Orson Welles. For me, he's just a hoax. It's empty. It's not interesting. It's dead. Susan Cain, which I have a copy of, is all the critics' darling, always at the top of every poll taken, but I think it's a total bore. Above all, the performances are worthless. The amount of respect that the movie got is absolutely unbelievable. And finally, Ingmar Bergman and Jean-Luc Godard. I've never gotten anything out of his movies. They have felt constructed, faux intellectual, and completely dead. Cinematography is uninteresting and infinitely boring. Godard is a fucking bore. He made his films for the critics. One of the movies, Masculine and Feminine, was shot here in Sweden. It was mind-numbingly boring as well. Then you've got Orson Welles on Jean-Luc Godard. His gifts as the director are enormous. I just can't take him very seriously as a thinker, and that's where we seem to differ, because he does. His message is what he cares about these days, and like most movie messages, it could be written on the head of a pen. And then finally, Werner Herzog takes a shot at Godard. Someone like Jean-Luc Godard is, for me, intellectual counterfeit money when compared to a good kung fu film.
Wow.
Okay, so now we get Tarantino gets slammed. Okay.
Oh, he gets slammed by everybody, I think.
Yes. Jean-Luc Godard said, Tarantino named his production company after one of my films. He'd have done better to give me some money. I don't know if that's really
I remember that. I remember when he said that.
Is that a slam? I'm not really sure. Harmony Korine on Quentin Tarantino. Boy, he doesn't have any place. Quentin Tarantino seems to be too concerned with other films. I mean, about appropriating other movies, like in a blender. I think it's like really funny at times. I'm seeing it, but at the time that I'm seeing it, but then I don't know. There's a void there. Some of the references are flat, just pop culture.
I think it's jealousy more than anything else.
Yeah.
I think that's an accurate description to a certain point.
It is an accurate description. Yeah. Remember, you can take that as a positive thing, too, because that's exactly Peter Rayner's review, I think, of Kill Bill Volume 2 in New York Magazine when it came out. That's the exact same thing. I think he used the word blender.
I mean,
I love Harmony Korine.
He wears his influences on his sleeve, Tarantino.
Yeah, I mean,
You'd be hard pressed to find a filmmaker that doesn't have an influence that informs what they do.
And, yeah.
And how the world works.
But I was thinking about Harmony Korine while watching The Bling Ring of all movies this weekend. I think a double feature of The Bling Ring and Spring Breakers is in my near future. I think we need to do like a 20-hour show devoted to both movies, because I like The Bling Ring and I like Spring Breakers, don't get me wrong. But they actually have the same problem with Man of Steel. It gets old after a while. We talk about the fight sequences in the second half of Man of Steel. Well, watching the Disney princesses, in their excesses and everything, and watching young adults steal in The Bling Ring, it gets old after a while. But there's a double feature that is waiting for me. If someone wants to buy me the Blu-rays, I'll give you my address in a private message. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Here's some more insults. Here's another director that I'm not too crazy about, Nick Broomfield. He's the documentary filmmaker who made Kurt and Courtney and Biggie and Tupac and a few other movies. Nick Broomfield on Quentin Tarantino, he says, it's like watching a schoolboy's fantasy of violence and sex, which normally Quentin Tarantino would be wanking alone to in his bedroom while his mother is making baked beans downstairs.
Can I say something about Miss Broomfield? I've seen
hold
it all.
Okay. Yeah. Well, hold on. He says only this time he's got Harvey Weinstein behind him, and it's on a million screens. So that's it. But yes, Nick Broomfield.
I think. I know. I like Heidi Fleiss, Hollywood Madam, but anyone who makes a movie Kurt and Courtney, and then implicates the singer from The Mentors in an assassination plot on Kurt Cobain deserves all the ridicule in the world for the rest of their life. I'm sorry.
He's always been an embarrassing filmmaker to me because he always feels like he's showing up at people's door without he has the camera rolling and the sound rolling, you know, and everything, and he just takes the camera up to somebody's door just flat, you know, and knocks on the door and just ambushes them or whatever.
He reminds
and
me
then,
of
then
the,
all you get is them like shooing him away or whatever, you know. So
he reminds me of someone at the reject table in Animal House. You remember where they go to the reject table all the time? And making fun of the person next to them at the reject.
Right.
I'm sorry. That's all he reminds me of. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I like the Eileen Wuornos documentary that he did.
Oh,
then,
yeah.
That was good. And then also he did a movie a long time ago with another director called Soldier Girls that was pretty good.
That's right.
But yeah, when he gets into talking about celebrities and so forth, it's like he's not prepared or something. He just goes out and does it or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and he's not prepared at all. And the movie is, talk about masturbatory. I mean, his movies are very masturbatory, if you ask me. Spike Lee on Quentin Tarantino, of course, you know, they've had it.
Oh, my God, here we go.
I'm not against the word, the N-word, and I use it, but not excessively. And some people speak like that way, but Quentin is infatuated with that word. What does he want to be made, an honorary black man? Actually, I think Quentin Tarantino does want to be an honorary black man.
Oh, I think that's a given. That's a given after Django. That's a given.
Yeah, I mean, Spike Lee's been a lot more insulting of Tarantino. That quote is not actually an insult. It's pretty much the truth about Tarantino.
He'd be the first to agree with that, I think. Mm.
But my favorite quote there, Dean, if you can go to the quote that we all know and love, from Clint Eastwood to Spike Lee.
Oh, yeah. nice and short. If a guy like him should shut his face.
That is a great one.
Yeah, that's the
best.
That
is really funny. You got the Spike Lee and Tyler Perry double bill. Spike Lee.
Oh yeah.
We got a black president and we're going back to Mantan Moreland and Sleep and Eat.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then Tyler Perry says, Spike Lee could go straight to hell. You can print that. Spike needs to shut the hell up. But Tyler Perry is terrible, let's face it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you're right. The Clint Eastwood one is the best. They've got a couple of here on Vincent Gallo. Vincent Gallo goes on a rampage.
Hates
at
everybody.
Let's hear the Vincent Gallo. Give us the Vincent Gallo one.
Yeah, he goes on a rampage. First off, on Spike Jones, he's the biggest fraud out there. If you bring him to the party, he's the least interesting person at the party. He's the person who doesn't know anything. He's the person who doesn't say anything funny, interesting, intelligent. He's a pig piece of shit.
Wow, okay.
Okay, that's one of the harshest.
That's harsh. That's harsh, man.
All of these by Vincent Gallo are very harsh.
Well, I wouldn't expect anything less, but...
Vincent Gallo on Martin Scorsese. I wouldn't work for Martin Scorsese for $10 million. He hasn't made a good film in 25 years. I would never work with an egomaniac cast in.
Wow, that's raw. That's just a chock full of wrong, but I mean, wow, okay.
he's really banking on the brown bunny.
Yeah. Vincent Gallo on Sophia and Francis Ford Coppola, which he worked with Coppola, so this is weird.
Yeah,
but
for Petro. For Petro. I mean,
this is strange. Sophia Coppola likes any guy who has what she wants. If she wants to be a photographer, she'll fuck a photographer. If she wants to be a filmmaker, she'll fuck a filmmaker. She's a parasite, just like her fat pig father was.
Oh, God, what a... That's horrible.
It is. These are terrible. So, Vincent
Gallo...
Vincent Gallo,
his major insult was to Roger Ebert. When he wished him colon cancer. And then Vincent Gallo was on the Howard Stern show, and Roger Ebert called in. And then Vincent Gallo made all nice with Roger Ebert because he was confronted. Vincent Gallo, this guy that never met a shower, I think that he's a wimp. Because as soon as any of these people confront him, I don't know when that Coppola quote was made, but maybe it was made before he worked for him for Tetro, and then Coppola comes to him with a job, and he makes all nice again. Because I've heard him talk glowingly of Coppola as well during that period. Okay. Here they are. Our good old reliable shadowlocked.com, 10 actors and actresses who deserve better roles. Not rolls as in a bakery, but rolls as in film.
I knew you were going to say that, too.
Wouldn't that be funny if it were about a bakery? Timothy Oliphant. He hasn't really come alive on film as he has on Justified, has he?
No. He was good in Go. I liked him in Go, and I liked him in the remake of The Crazies, but I forgot that he was in Go. It's been a long time since I've seen that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, he seems to be, you know, more of a TV actor now. And, I mean, I think that's where he's found his sea legs.
Yeah.
But you ain't got no legs, Lieutenant Dan. my favorite line in Forrest Gump, actually. That is. Nathan Fillion. He's this Whedon guy, right? He's the guy that everybody likes.
He was in Much Ado About Nothing. He was good in that, but he's also on that show Castle. He's found a lot of success on that. So I mean,
he's the Firefly guy. So that's I always and he did another movie. Didn't he do this? What was that movie they did about the Creep or Slime or something like that?
No, Slither. He did Slither, and he was in Serenity, but he was pretty good. He's got Castle going for him.
You know what, though? Doesn't it prove the point that he needs better roles when you're like, yeah, but he was in Slither.
Slither. Michael Rooker was in Slither, and we had him on the show, so.
I mean, but, yeah, I mean, I think what these people want is, I guess, naming these two guys, these two square job guys, you know, that's the first two people on this list, is they want them to be movie superstars, is what they're saying. And I'm not really sure if they're superstar sized, but.
Okay. Yeah, well, let's go. What's the next one?
Well, he was good in the movie that I like a whole lot, in Waitress. He was in that.
Oh, he was very good in that, yeah.
Yeah.
Jennifer Aniston.
She definitely do. I'd love to see her. It's funny, you know, a lot of people denigrate Jennifer Aniston, but I'm still sticking up for her because I want her to return to those days when she was. I like it when she does indie movies, when she does things like Friends with Money or The Good Girl, stuff like that.
She's the one, but. She did The Horrible Bosses, which is she was really funny in that, but she's got this one, We're the Millers, but I don't think that's going to be the one to bring her back. But
although I'm telling you what, she is really, for a 45-year-old lady, you know, she's looking pretty goddamn good.
Oh, my God, are we really think 45 is old? Okay, all right.
Dean,
I don't want to lose the boomer.
There's not a lot of 45-year-old ladies
dressing up watching, in bikinis in movies.
I was watching, what's that movie? What's the name of the movie with her and Life Happens or Love Happens?
Oh, the one with Aaron Eckhart, Life Happens,
yeah.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, and I actually like that movie because here's a, like a rom-com, something
mm-hmm.
promoted as a rom-com. And it goes much deeper than that. It's really about dealing with grief and loss and how they
yeah.
meet among those conditions. And I thought it was really good. And peripherally, I thought she looked phenomenal in that movie.
No,
Jennifer Aniston, baby.
His story in that is, you know, like you talk about, is the thing that really propels the movie. He's a fraud. I mean.
Yeah, yeah. But she hasn't. She hasn't really come alive in films yet. And remember, I think she's still stuck in that early George Clooney phase when he couldn't get a break in film, you know, before the Soderbergh
mm-hmm.
Out of Sight came
out of
about.
Sight.
You know,
mm-hmm.
she's stuck in that.
But what about
that
Office
pre-Out
Space?
Of Sight rut.
What about like something like Office Space or Season
Office
1?
Space.
Or...
Yeah.
I mean these are
cool
films we're talking about. We're not talking about blockbusters, obviously, but
people forget that
we're talking about a role.
We're
talking about the vehicle that offers her a role to take off on, and,
right,
and
okay.
she hasn't found that yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
John C. Reilly.
Really? Are we? I mean, he's been. I mean, you could say Wreck-It Ralph is the thing that for all ages, but he's been in so many. He's a great character actor. I mean,
they're not saying that these people suck. In this
no,
but he is
having
them recognized.
I think he gets tons of good roles. I feel like almost everything. If he's in something, it's like okay, that'll be something. I mean, you know, he's good in everything he's in. So I mean, I think he's doing just fine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he really needs any help. I mean,
that's one I would strongly disagree with. The problem that
yeah.
I have is, and maybe this is happening, maybe it's not, I don't want to see his career go the way of Vince Vaughn, where he finds a niche doing juvenile comedies, and then that's all he ends up doing.
I don't think that he's going to do that, because, I mean...
Yeah, but he's doing things like Carnage, though, and...
Yeah, and even something like The Promotion, which I think is one
Harry.
Of the most under
yeah, The Promotion was great, and then there's something like Terry. There's a movie
yeah.
he made a couple of years ago, Terry, that was very good, too. So I don't think he's going there. Vince Vaughn could take a lesson and try to do some more of the indie films that made him so great.
And to take the kind of roles that John C. Reilly actually does take and still
yeah.
take. You know, I mean, he's willing to take a really tiny role in something, or they only have three scenes, or I don't know. I don't agree with that. I think John C. Reilly is exactly where he should be.
Okay, Billy Bob Thornton.
Now this is an interesting one.
He's just checked out, I think. That's my impression of Billy Bob Thornton, is that he's checked out his movies.
But when he's good, like in Sling Blade or One False Move.
Well, again,
or,
you know, this isn't a simple plan.
About
whether these guys are good or not. This is just whether they're as big movie stars as they should be. I think that's what these guys
are accepting as good a caliber of role as they should be playing. And I think your argument with John C. Reilly is, you know, how many Talladega Nights and Step Brothers and Walk Hards are you going to do? When are these movies kind of beneath you when you make them a habit? And Billy Bob Thornton has done, admittedly, he's done his fair share of paycheck movies, and he's fine with that.
Yes. No, he has, but then he does something like is Bad Santa the last really, truly great? That was 10 years ago.
It's been a long time since we've seen something, you know, really, really terrific from him. But, I mean, you know, to get back to John C. Reilly, I mean, let's don't forget he was in, we need to talk about Kevin.
That's right.
He's switching it up all the time, you know, just because
it's those movies like Step Brothers and so forth, the Talladega Nights. Well, those are just the big hits.
Step Brothers, that was actually a very good movie. I actually think Step Brothers, of all those movies, of the big comedy movies, is actually very good.
I like them. I like Step Brothers and Walk Hard, too. And Talladega Nights. I mean, I think he's really hilarious in it.
Next on the list, Christina Ricci.
That's a good one.
She's another person that seems to me to have checked out of movies. I mean,
she's so good in The Opposite of Sex and even Monster, but I haven't seen her in anything recently.
I wonder if Hollywood finds her kind of hard to cast in some ways because. Because of her unusual look it's funny, you know, I like Christina Ricci better when she was, you know, a little chubbier, you know, and then when they made her lose all the weight or when she lost all the weight or whatever, I thought she looked kind of strange, like, what, your head looks too big for your body or something, I don't know. She lost something. She lost something very essential to her. Just her general look for me. And
Matthew Broderick.
If you play Peter Fuller, do you really need to do anything else? I mean,
now he's kind of gone into character actor mode, hasn't he?
Yeah, but he's also, isn't he very good? Big on, still, whenever he does anything on Broadway or on stage, I mean.
Yeah, he succeeds most of the time with that. I think he did something like Something Happened on the Way to the Forum or something a little while ago.
Right.
And Nathan Lane, of course, is like lives on the stage.
Right.
I think his most critically acclaimed performance he just did on the stage. I don't know, Matthew Broderick. He's never been an electrifying presence, and you know, I talked to him for the show. And he actually admitted that, you know, he fell out of love with acting for a while. And with the indie films, he started getting reignited a little bit. But he's always been, for me personally, kind of a bland presence, Ferris Bueller notwithstanding. But, you know, he's done a lot of crap movies. And I think most of the crap movies came at that time when he started to fall out of love with it.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know. He's a star because of War Games and John Hughes with Ferris Bueller. He's not a
good.
You
Can Count on Me, though. He was good in the part that he had, and You Can Count on Me.
The cable guy, Election.
Election.
It's fantastic in that. You know, he's slightly miscast in Glory, but he's still good at it. And I guess the last major movie that he was in, at least major for film lovers, is Margaret. You know, but it's a small role in that pretty big movie. But now it seems like he's doing mostly just TV appearances and stuff on Broadway. So.
That's what I've always said about Matthew Broderick. There's just, and it goes to the whole plane thing. He's become like a major fuddy-duddy. Like you see him now, and he's wearing bow ties everywhere he goes, and it's like the antithesis of Ferris Bueller.
Well, it happens to all of us. So
I don't think he has a free-spirited personality enough to get back on top again with a major exciting role. You know. Alan Rickman.
Does Alan Rickman really care?
No, it's just about what this particular blogger cares about.
Alan Rickman's done a lot of good stuff. I mean, we've seen some of those movies, Noble Son, and obviously the Harry Potter movies he was superb in. I mean, come on. And he's the greatest diehard villain of them all.
Yeah, I mean he's somebody too that's just a character actor. He's not.
Yeah,
he's never gonna be. he's never going to be somebody who's, you know, above the title unless, you know, he's part of like a huge cast, like he's going to be in The Butler playing Ronald Reagan. But
yeah, I mean,
he's just a character actor, and you know, that's what some of these guys like the John C. Reilly conversation.
It's
you
a
know.
Great gig if you can get it, character actor. If you can get that gig,
yeah.
That's an awesome gig.
Yeah.
Has he ever been nominated for an Academy Award?
No, he's never been nominated for an Academy Award. No.
He hasn't. I think they're arguing for him to play that kind of role. And you know what? I don't know why, but the first thing that came to my mind is he really needs to find a lead character like Michael Douglas played in The Wonder Boys, or Michael Caine played in Educating Rita, or something like
that.
Yeah,
right. Michael Caine. Like, he needs to take a page out of Michael Caine's book. I agree.
I can completely see him doing that and completely shining in something like that, you know?
Uh-huh.
Last one that they list here, I think is the last one. Yeah, it is. Greg Kinnear.
Oh, now that's somebody I just don't have any real big feelings about. That's somebody I find...
He's talented and everything, you know, but I just don't see him carrying a big movie, you know, or I just don't see it.
I watched that movie where he played the guy who invented the windshield wipers.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen that. I need
Invention. Invention. What's the title of that movie? Something Invention.
Forward or something? Or?
Something forward,
but he was
something
good.
Invention.
Let me tell you this, though. He's so disturbing in autofocus, that's got to count for something.
Yeah,
okay.
I think autofocus and As Good As It Gets are the two best roles he had.
Little Miss Sunshine. Little Miss Sunshine, you got to put in there. Everyone's good in that.
By the way, Flash of Genius.
Yeah. Flash of Genius should have been good. Because I remember seeing the trailer for that, and I said, oh, man, that's going to be great. That movie was so dead. I mean, it was like
It was. It was really, it just went nowhere.
Okay, but I liked him in autofocus a lot. I mean...
Autofocus is a
great role.
Yeah.
I
think that's
an anomaly. I reference autofocus once every couple of months.
You do?
I do. To people I know and to myself. But I do reference it, too.
I really do. I forgot about The Matador. He's good in that, too.
Oh, The Matador is wonderful, yeah.
Yeah.
Who can forget his work in Robots? I mean,
Robots is definitely. What was Robots?
Animated.
That was
animated. Oh yeah. Okay, yeah.
Well, I do remember him as Captain Amazing in Mystery Men, and
Mystery Men is a great movie. No one ever gives that movie the credit it deserves.
That
is very funny.
That movie is hysterical. I don't understand why people. Does that movie have a cult following?
It does have a cult following. It's based on a cult comic book. But that movie, I mean, for a while, that was Ben Stiller's greatest role.
We'll close the show with our final guests.
Definitely. The Clan of the Vane, right?
The Clan of the Vane, yes. Will it be better than Clan of the Cave Bear? That's the major test here.
Most things are, but...
Yes. The great thing about that movie is the score from James Horner. Let me just say that. And isn't there like a Doggy Style with Daryl Hannah in that movie?
I remember we watched it on Labor Day weekend on videotape.
There's so many Daryl Hannah Doggy Style movies to choose from.
That might be our list next week.
That's actually her nickname, Daryl Doggy Style Hannah.
I always get that movie mixed up with Quest for Fire. So.
Me too. Yes.
And that's really funny because there's a lot of great doggy style acts.
And Quest for Fire is the movie where Ray Dong Chong gets the Ray Long Dong put to
him. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. All right. Clan of the Vane is a new project. It's a graphic novel slash feature film project that's being described as Die Hard with vampires. It's mounted a Kickstarter campaign that you can go support. They're really close to their goal, and I'm hoping that this segment will kick them right over. We're joined by the producers of this project, Neil Fisher, Neil DeMonte, and Neo Edmond. They were lovely to talk to, and they have some definite ideas about where Kickstarter is going, stuff that we've talked about before as a panel with Zach Braff and now James Franco and that whole dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an exciting project. Here they are to discuss Clan of the Vane. Tell me, I've read all about your project, Clan of the Vane, and you guys have a very clever, you guys sell it in a very clever one-liner, Die Hard with Vampires.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That's terrific. Tell me exactly what that means.
Yeah, basically we like the basic Die Hard format about a character who's kind of like put in a situation that they have to deal with and with a bunch of other people they have to kind of control. So is that a good way of explaining
that?
Well,
if you could imagine Die Hard where all the terrorists storm into the building and take over the place, if those were all monsters and creatures and you know, vampire type, you know, creatures taking over the place, and then the hero has to systematically take them out and, you know, and rescue the hostages. It's pretty much, that's what we mean Die Hard with vampires.
The additional thing that is a similarity with Clan of the Vane and Die Hard is that at the heart of the Die Hard story is actually kind of a love story.
Mm-hmm.
And so just the same thing is true with Clan of the Vane. There is a centuries long, kind of a love tragedy that is fueling one of the main ongoing background stories of the McBain character. And, you know, and he's, you know, trying to find her and, you know, piecing things together. And that story is, you know, will continue. Not, I mean, it's introduced in our initial comic, but it's something that will be revisited and you know, a continuous theme throughout the comic book series.
Is that always a particular challenge when you're developing material like this to kind of mix the fantastical with the human?
I personally don't think it's a difficulty. I think it's one of those things that they help. You know, I mean, if you're only fantastical or you're only action based or you're only romantic based, I think that's where things get stale and limited. Mm-hmm. It's when you start, you know, I mean, real life is full of it. You know, I mean, my friend just got in a car accident the other day and her life was completely turned upside down. You know, I mean, you know, she doesn't have a car. She can't get to work. The car is probably going to be totaled. She's got now physical injuries. You know, I mean, you know, one event, one thing can, you know, just spin your life around.
Well, I always really admired projects that can do that, and not all of them can. I mean, a lot of what we see coming out of Hollywood, it's so kind of CGI infested, and it's almost like the movie serves the CGI instead of the other way around. And what they're missing is the human element. And I think of something like Cronenberg's version of The Fly, which is a movie you'd think, you know, a guy turns into a fly. It has to be silly and fantastical. But what makes that movie resonate is that it has such a strong, vivid love story in the center of it.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's I forgot who wrote it, but when I was living in Japan and trying to teach myself how to write screenplays, I read a screenwriting book that talked about small moments. And one of the examples they gave was in Dances with Wolves, when his horse is getting stolen, and Kevin Costner's character jumps up and tries to run out and save his horse, and as doing so, forgets that the door to the front of his building is about a foot too short, and knocks himself out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then he wakes up, you know, hours later or whatever, and the horse is like walking back.
And they're small human moments. We've all hit our head, you know, and heroes hit their heads too.
Yeah, and it's that kind of moment that automatically endears you to the lead character. I agree. So tell me about your conception of vampires in this project, because we've seen all kinds of vampires. They've been kind of turned into teenage sex pots recently, glittery, shiny vampires.
Yeah,
where do you fall in? I'm sorry, just where do you fall in the conception of your vampires?
Monte should speak to that.
Yeah, basically, we can talk about the main character in a bit, but like the thing with our vampires, what's different is this is a monster film, and also a monster comic book that we're doing, actually. We want to basically, you know, we want to take things back the way like vampires used to be. We don't like the fact that everyone's like really pretty and cute, and like, I mean, we do have a romantic story, but the thing is, our characters are monsters. The thing is, vampires are, you know, we as human beings are there, we're like, you know, they're like a predatory species for humans. They're the next level up on the food chain. We don't want to have, you know, like the typical, like, you know, cutesy ones, too. We really wanted to have these things. These are vicious creatures. They're going to eat you and drink your blood. You are, us as humans, we are their food. So, like, the thing is, there's so many different cultural aspects towards vampires that have never been explored before, you know, like in comic books that we think we are actually doing with our project. For example, you've got the East Indian Rakshasa vampire, which looks like this big, like kind of like this werewolf-type looking type thing, which doesn't look like the typical like vampire that walks down the street like in the other classic human-looking forms we have.
Yeah, in fact, we think it's like a werewolf, you know?
Yeah,
pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, they're like these big pack dogs, you know, with like stripes, and they have like mange on them and stuff too. And then we've got, for example, there's a Germanic species of vampire called an Entoder vampire, and that's a creature that's like really deadly, and like just a simple stake through the heart will not kill this thing actually is allergic to lemon juice. So like our main character would have to think of these specific ways on how to kill these creatures without having a typical like stake through the heart type situation.
Huh.
And that was what makes this story so fun for us as storytellers, is that it's not a simple stake through the heart. It's not holy water or something, you know, or the typical thing. So
yeah,
you know,
every time you're trying to kill a vampire, you also have to figure out the mystery of what is that vampire's weakness. It's not just a given.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at, because the Kickstarter page that you have for Clan of the Vane, it includes samples of some of the drawings and illustrations, and they are beautifully realized. I mean, it's stunning artwork.
And that's only a fraction of it.
I
have to say that I've been telling them, no more.
Not showing all this stuff.
No.
We want to show everybody all this rad stuff that
Neil's been
drawing. And,
yeah, it's so cool. Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, you know.
I mean, there's dozens of different types of vampires, and as DeMonte has said, that they're, you know, they're all based on actual cultural vampires from around the world. You know, that doesn't stop us as creatives from mixing and matching and creating our own. But we're definitely inspired by real vampiric lore from around the world.
So the objective here is to begin with a graphic novel.
Absolutely.
And then graduate that into a film project.
Small detail. I would say we want both. We as a movie producer, I was immediately attracted to Clan of the Vane, not only because there's two awesome dudes that are creating it,
woo-hoo,
but also in that it's a honest to goodness solid comic book storyline that with a great character that can that can on its own stand up as a great comic book.
Yeah.
But as a movie producer and really I love things that are multi-platform. This thing can really be could be really a great movie. It could make a great video game. And so our first step is to get that comic book out, get the first double issue, you know, really solid graphic novel out there. And then we've already had some people questioning us about the film rights. So, you know, and I usually just tell them that, you know, let's wait to see when the comic book comes out.
Yeah, let's get the comic book done first, because when Neil and I started on this, that's what this was. We had the story idea, we had these characters, we both grew up loving comic books, reading comic books. I mean, comic books sort of taught me to read, or at least made it capable for, you know, this sort of ADD dyslexic kid to learn to actually read. So comic books are very important to me, and, you know.
Yeah, same here.
Never mind,
exactly.
Probably all three of us. That would probably be true.
Yeah, I was reading comic books, taking them to class.
Exactly.
I was told, no more comic books, don't bring comic books, and I would argue that, you know, I mean, I remember I was maybe second grade, and I was being told to not bring comic books to class, and I would argue that the vocabulary in the comic book was higher than the writing, you know, what we were reading in class, and the teachers, of course, would get angry at me, and we would argue.
Right.
But the reality was that, yes, the comic books are not written. Most, like Spider-Man, most superhero-type comic books are not written at second or third or fourth grade. They're written at fifth, sixth, seventh, even up to eighth grade. The vocabulary that's in there. So
that's true.
Yeah, you know, I mean, like Uncanny X-Men. Tell me how many second graders know what uncanny means?
Right.
Yeah.
They haven't read X-Men, they won't have a clue.
Comic books is where you go look up. Like, speaking of that, like, I actually looked up that word when I was a kid.
I did too. That's why I brought it up.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
I was in first grade and I was asking my mom and dad what that word means.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, as a former educator, I think comic books are a great tool for education, and, you know, as well as storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went through a period of my life where I did collect comic books. I certainly haven't been a lifetime collector, because my single obsession in life has always been movies. But in a way, as such a big movie lover, I appreciated comic books, because just in telling the story, the nature of the structure of a comic book, they look like extremely elaborate storyboards.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So
if you create this, when you create this comic book and graphic novel, I'm sure to some extent you can call upon your work in the comic book as a source of storyboard in some way, can't you?
Is that Mr. DeMonte here is also a very accomplished storyboard artist.
Well, thanks. But yeah, that's kind of was my year when I did the comic book. If you really look at it very carefully, the whole thing is very cinematically laid out. From the colors down to the design of everything, I really wanted to give it like an actual cinematic touch to it, which is why I worked on movies like Bunraku and Day of the Dead. And my storytelling, I think, kind of, it's definitely graphic novel style, because I like to have a lot of, I like to be able to set a mood and create the characters that reside in that environment. But by working as a storyboard artist with a lot of people, it actually kind of helped, you know, like, hone my skills. So that way, if you actually look at the comic book the way it's set up, you can actually translate that directly into screenshots from the book. And that's kind of what I think sets our book apart a little bit differently from other people's projects. If that's a good way of
putting it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So tell me more about the Kickstarter campaign. The money you raise is going to go towards what exactly?
Completing the graphic novel at this point. Neil DeMonte here has done, you know, he's done a lot of pencil, you know, he's drawn a lot of pages. We still want to do more pages, and then we also need to get the pages colored, and, you know, the colorist needs to get paid. We need to get, you know, we need to get the thing lettered, you know, we need to get the thing printed, published. I mean, all of those things cost money. And at this point, you know, it is the three of us doing this. We don't have big studio money backing us up. We don't have a big, you know, rich producer in our back pocket, you know, taking care of this for us. So so the Kickstarter money is all going into the comic book. None of it's going into our pockets, you know. So that's getting the book done right now for us is the most important thing. And for me, you know, the thing I want more than anything, Neil and Neo doing a graphic novel together, you know, that's a dream, you know. So
yes, they're all best. And we all like working together on our project, because we've all done projects independently of each other in film and comic books. But this is the first time, like, us as fans are actually going to be able to, we're all fans of this genre, so this is the first time us as fans are going to be able to actually do something for the kids that actually, like, you know, are back in Dayton, Ohio, for example, looking up to us going, God, I wish I could do a comic book. And, like, we kind of want to do something back to those kids. We were in that same position, just, like, not that
long. Yeah, I grew up in Iowa.
Yeah.
You know, and I was definitely that kid in Iowa that wanted to be comic book writer, comic book artist, movie maker, you know, work in TV, you know, something like, you know, any one of those or all of them. And it was just a dream that was so unrealistic for a small town boy from Iowa, you know, that I didn't really pursue it, you know, initially. I decided to do a real job, and I became a teacher. And so I would definitely encourage people, and, you know, I think this first comic, you know, can be really kind of dedicated to, you know, the fans and the kids, and be an inspiration for anyone to do it themselves.
And on that note, the great thing about Kickstarter is that we will actually at the end get to own what we've done, and, you know, versus going to a major publisher that, you know, would put the money in, but then they would own all the rights to it, they would control it, and we wouldn't really, you know, be able to stick to our artistic vision.
Yeah, so then if we wanted to make a movie out of it, the company would make all the money from it, even though we're the ones that created the cool stuff to begin with.
Yeah, we create everything, we do all the work, and, you know, they put in a little bit of money, and they get, you know, 90% of everything or something, you know, and maybe give us some crumbs that fall off the table. And I've done that already enough times working for other companies, and this is time for us to do this thing that we're passionate about and actually get to have control of it. And the Kickstarter, you know, community can give that to us if they're willing to give us a chance.
The great thing, what I love about Kickstarter is that it is the great equalizer with the phrase cash is king.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, right now, I mean, it's always been this way, but probably more so now than in many other times in history, that cash is king. And, you know, you can, I mean, you watch the show, what is that show, Shark Tank? People come in with great ideas, and they've already been doing it for months or years, and, you know, and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, I make belts that no one else can make, you know, and it can fit everybody and blah, 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 and I've been selling it door to door for years. And then it's like, okay, I'll give you $15,000, but I'll own 90% of it. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, this dude created something that you know, completely from scratch, and then works his, you know, I mean, literally works his fingers to the bone, and then owns 10% of his own company. Of his own creation. So I love Kickstarter because of that. You know, I mean, I do too.
You know, because just as you've expressed, it allows you to retain control of your vision without compromise. But what it also does, I mean, you mentioned growing up in, I think you said Iowa, and not feeling like you had any opportunity to become a part of entertainment at all. But it allows people like that all across the world to step out and feel like they're part of the process instead of spectating, dreaming.
Been around when I was a kid. I can tell you, there'd be, you know, I mean, Kickstarter would be one of my bookmarked favorite pages, and I'd be, you know, telling Mom, "Oh, Mom, let's get into that. We need to get this one." I'd be out lawn, you know, mowing three more lawns to, you know, so I could put another $25 into Crown of the Vein or whatever project I wanted to be at the time, yeah.
And on that note, you know, we are all supporters of other people's Kickstarters. So
many
of our friends have done this successfully, and we all support each other, and that's what's kind of awesome is, you know, my friend Jeremy Steen just raised $100,000 for his video game documentary. I mean, he was going to go out and get financing from some producer who was going to take like 75% of it, you know?
Yep.
And he's been working on this thing for 2 years, going around the world, financing it off just credit cards, and then some guy's going to walk in, some rich producer, essentially with pocket change. For him, this rich producer is going to own 75%, you know? And it's like, oh, but Kickstarter, the community jumped on, they supported him, now he owns this whole movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep, and they're all part of it, like you said. It's just a positive, you know, push it forward mentality.
Yep. So,
you know, and in the worst case scenario, Kickstarter is a wonderful pre-order system, you know, where people get to pre-order what they want for maybe a slightly little bit more than what they might pay retail, but then they're getting signed things and they're getting, you know, extra stickers or things like that. So it all kind of balances out, and they get, you know, thanked on, you know, on web pages or even in the piece material themselves. So it's just a great positive push it forward attitude.
Yeah.
In an otherwise, you know, more and more corporate corrupt system.
Yeah. I agree with you, man. But on this note, I mean, since we're talking about Kickstarter, I wanted to ask your opinion on the big controversy surrounding Kickstarter in the past month or two, with people that are not necessarily as independent as you guys are, like a Zach Braff or a James Franco that just signed.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, Zach Braff put in $10,000 into my friend Jeremy Sneed's Kickstarter, and actually that $10,000 and that endorsement actually helped his Kickstarter probably succeed. So Zach Braff did pay it forward, and I give him a lot of kudos for that. So I'm pretty sure it had a lot to do with my friend's Kickstarter actually, you know, really breaking out. So
yeah, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? I mean, perhaps there should be like Kickstarter and Kickstarter Pro. You know, where you know, where
really
you have
idea.
Okay, these are the people that have hundreds of thousands or millions of fans that are built in, and the capability of getting financing right away. You know, now, I mean, on you know, so the question is, I mean, even though, I mean, I work at Davis Films and we make movies like Resident Evil and Silent Hill, and I'm friends with a lot of the people that we work with here, and you know, big stars don't necessarily always have the cash flow that we assume they do. Yeah, I mean, they, you know, many of them go through divorces. They, you know, they decide, oh, you know, I mean, like I manage Sonny Chiba, and you know, you would think that one of the biggest action martial art movie stars the world has ever seen would have millions of dollars, but he decided to sock most, if not all, of his money into a movie that he made in Japan that failed miserably, and he lost a lot of his fortune. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, it is a controversy for me, because I don't like the idea that people that already have access to millions of dollars, either out of their pocket or going up to a company and saying, okay, my name can sell X amount, so let's make a movie. It's clearly not on the same level as people like us, or you know the kids in Arizona that are trying to make their own graphic novel that have never even stepped foot in Hollywood.
When you pitch an idea to the studios, or to anyone really, they want to know the template. Where has your strategy succeeded in the past and other people's projects? So, I mean, owning this property yourselves, what do you look for as the template, the project that worked equally well from graphic novel or comic book to video game to feature film? What's the pinnacle for you?
I don't necessarily think there's a perfect example. First of all, because of how Hollywood is changing, and I mean, it used to be that, like, for example, DVDs would made half of your profits. So the whole industry is changing, and it's moving very, very fast. So to figure that out is probably rather difficult. Although, as Neo mentioned, I mean, The Crow is certainly one very good example of a comic book that was successfully adapted into a film. And I mean, it was a film franchise, and it got a limited run, kind of as a TV series. So you know, clearly that's one. I mean,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Then you've got like you can also have like the I think what it called the Oscar version, which is like Road to Perdition. It was a really good comic book, but then it was adapted into a really good film that was like considered an art film, most like an action one, like Blade, for example.
Yeah, which ironically was a comic book inspired by Lone Wolf and Cub, which is effectively an action comic.
Right.
Yeah. So tell me ideally what the timeline is here. When you expect to complete the graphic, the comic book, and when you expect to begin work on the film?
Well, right now, we need to get the comic, the graphic novel done. Once the Kickstarter closes, we're assuming successfully. So then, we're going to get right down to finishing what we've done.
Mm-hmm.
We're definitely going to do some additional pages,
right,
so that we can expand the story and do more. When Neil and I started this, we were going to do a 22-page comic because that's all we could have ever possibly afforded to do. And but we, of course, want it to be much longer. And, the Kickstarter money will definitely afford us the opportunity to do a much more extensive story. And once we get that done, we get it published, we get it out there, then, and we see how people respond to it and see, how much people really like it, then that's when we can start, thinking about a film,
Yeah, also, the more successful the comic book is, the more awareness that Kickstarter gives us, the more awareness that, we're going to, ideally we'll debut Clan of the Vane in its first published form at Stan Lee's Kamikaze. So hopefully that will also get us a lot of attention. So the more well known our graphic novel is, the more leverage we have as content owners to make a decent deal with a company, a production company that would make our film.
Yeah. On top of that too, we ideally want this to be a first issue. It's a pilot issue. But we actually want to ideally make this into an actual series too. So provide with fan response, which so far has been pretty good. I'm kind of very flattered by that, as we all are.
Yeah.
I think like us to ideally make this into a series, because this is something we all created together, and this is something we would love to actually present as a whole new character. Because you've got a character who's a vampire who's been alive for hundreds if not thousands of years. So why not make an entire series based on all these adventures from all these different timelines of his lifetime? And that's what I think would be a really cool thing.
Yeah, was McBane in the Trojan War? Was he riding on a Viking ship? What was he doing during the Renaissance? I mean, did he take the plans of the pyramid to the Aztecs? Those are all like really cool storylines that we could follow up on if we want to.
Okay, that was Neil Fisher, Neil DeMonte, and Neo Edmund. Their new project is called Clan of the Vane. You can support it right now at Kickstarter.com, and we thank them for giving us their time. We'll close up the show with a piece of film score. What do you want to hear? I'll give you guys a choice. You can hear the score for After Earth.
No.
Or, let's see, what else do I have here?
A resounding no for that.
We don't want anything to do with that movie.
No, anything would be better than that. Even like the love theme from Gamera versus never mind.
Okay, we'll play. Okay, I got Cuckoo's Nest here. Let's play the theme from Cuckoo's
Nest. Let's do Cuckoo's Nest. Oh my God, really? There's not even a choice there. I mean, After Earth goes in the Cuisinart.
We close
tonight
with Cuckoo's Nest.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
See you later.